Glyndebourne is a very extraordinary place, and it lives up to its reputation in every way, I would say. It is a sort of mythical, magical place. It is an opera house, a private opera house in the countryside of Sussex, sitting within the downs, surrounded by fields of sheep, and it is beautiful. It has some of the finest operatic productions, I would say, in the world, some of the finest performers, directors, and so forth. It is privately owned, run by the Christie family, who founded it back in the 30s. It's now run by the grandson of the original founder, and it is a very extraordinary place.
Part of the myth is it is a kind of gathering ground for the great and good.
It is. But
nothing wrong with that. No. I do not sit in judgment on the great and good.
Of course. It is still very much part of the social season, actually. But it's a place that attracts true lovers of opera. So you get the great mix of the society set who want to be seen, the business set who want to impress their investors, but also you get the truly passionate opera lovers who will stand with their thermos flasks.
What do you do there? What do you do at Glyndebourne? What's your connection to the place?
For the past 14 years, I have been offering my services as physical therapist at Glyndebourne, and that includes hands-on work, but also yoga. I teach a very particular sort of yoga, which I also have taught at the request of English National Opera. I'll go and do courses there on their Young Artists Programme. And so my services are fairly broad. I'm on call, so that if there's any particular emergency, and surprisingly there often are. For example, there is a great fashion for the raked stage, and the more adventurous designers will go for a double-raked stage, which plays havoc on the skeletal systems of the performers.
The rake stage is the angled stage, so it's a double rake then is at a greater upward angle.
Or two angles on the same set.
Oh, I see.
Two extreme angles on the same set.
The rake's progress.
Very good.
I'm sure it's been said before.
And of course, if a performer is rehearsing on the rake for a lengthy period, for a number of weeks, and especially if they're in character shoes that have a particular heel, what that will do is exacerbate any underlying skeletal problems, but also bring back to the surface old back trouble, neck trouble, hip joint trouble, for example. And so that can be particularly trying. And of course, for a singer who is so sensitive about the positioning of the body, which has an immediate impact on the quality and the production of the voice, working on a rake, working under physical stress and even pain, has an enormous impact, shakes their confidence, and affects the voice itself.
Well, you've also worked as a theater designer. Does no one sit down before the fact with the people who are going to be making the decisions about rake or double rake and say, by the way, these are human engineered pieces that are going to be playing out there on the stage. Take that into account. Surely that happens.
You'd like to think so, but it doesn't seem to. It doesn't seem to. And directors also there is a tendency, I think, in theatrical production generally, but especially in opera, for a more filmistic production. Mm-hmm. So the demands on singers today are quite different from what they were 20 or 30 years ago. They're expected to act in a way that wasn't once expected or even fashionable on the operatic stage. And therefore, the singers are expected to produce exquisite sounds and passionate arias whilst crawling on their hands and knees or dangling upside down. For example, I was working with the team that were doing Hansel and Gretel, and both witches in the season production and the touring production had to wear enormous latex bodysuits until they became very overweight Hausfrau-y women. And that in itself was very stressful. They had enormous breasts, for example, which caused massive strain on the upper back and neck. They were also
crafted enormous breasts.
Crafted, exactly. Uh-huh. Yes, crafted. All in latex. They were then expected to clamber up an enormous structure on the set, which was actually a supermarket. And at the point of the witch's death, they had to tumble down a hole, drop out of sight from the audience onto enormous mattresses. Well, this was very frightening for the performers to start with, to let themselves drop over the edge, but also with the extraordinarily heavy weight on the front. And both of them suffered terribly because of it. And so throughout the rehearsal period, as soon as the latex bodysuit was being used, throughout the rehearsal period and throughout the production period, I was constantly having to work on them to get their bodies back in line in order that they could get back on stage and get that suit back on.
Well, how do you do that? You just crack them?
I try to avoid, but it is necessary sometimes. But it's mostly restoring balance to the body. Mm-hmm. That's how I'd prefer to work. So there's no great dramatic intervention. And again, because singers are particularly sensitive about their bodies because of the impact it has on the voice and on the breath, you have to work quite subtly. So I work very much in order to restore the equilibrium, if you like, of the physical structure.
How much of what you do is intuitive, in a way? I mean, are you able to look at somebody and say, okay, well, this is what is at issue here?
Yes, I do have to work very intuitively. And a lot of my training has been done in India, although my qualifications have had to be taken in Britain to get the necessary insurance and so forth. A lot of my bodywork training has actually happened in India, where they don't work from the Western medical point of view, but very much from an intuitive human point of view. And so placing my hands on a person's body, I was taught, for example, to think of the body as water. So I place my hands on the surface of water, and you feel where the currents are. I mean, that sounds a little bit esoteric, but it is actually physically possible to do that. You can feel the quality of somebody's body. You can feel imbalance in the body. And that is done intuitively rather than purely intellectually.
What are the currents that you're feeling? Are you feeling, I don't know what to call it exactly, energy flow, what in Chinese tradition might be called qi, or are you feeling muscles out of place?
There's an aspect to that. There's an aspect of qi, or shakti, as it is in the Indian tradition, the vibration of the body. And it is very much like placing the hands on the surface of water. I don't know a better way to explain it, really. But it seems to work. So I go with it. I trust it, because it's worked for 14 years.
Well, tell me about the yoga practice that you have. It's some kind of tantric yoga. Okay, I hear tantric yoga, and I have to say my mind veers right away to sex.
Exactly.
Mind you, I hear latex bodysuit, and the same thing happens.
Absolutely. Well, I can promise we all keep our pants on. Let's start from there. The yoga that I teach comes from the northeast Himalaya, the Bengal Himalaya, where the old tantra tradition survives. Now, in the West, tantra is very much associated with a titillating concept of sexual practice, where in fact the tantric tradition is simply the heterodox tradition of Hinduism.
Don't know what heterodox
means. It's the non-orthodox tradition. So it's anti-hierarchical. It is extraordinarily embracing, and that's where the sexual aspect has been misunderstood. It embraces every aspect of human experience, including the sensual aspect. Mm-hmm. And so the sexual part is very, very small. So the tantric tradition is an extremely broad concept, a world view. And within that, there is a yogic tradition. In fact, the Hatha tradition that most people think of, which includes Iyengar, Ashtanga, and so forth, all come from this same tradition originally.
So tantra is a philosophy, yoga is part of the
part
way...
Part of that. It's the physical expression or exploration of that philosophy, if you like. And part of that yogic tradition is very much a Himalayan tradition. For example, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, it has its own yogic tradition practiced in the monasteries. The monasteries were divided into the scholar monks and the military monks, because the old army of Tibet were taken from the monks under the age of 40, the most physically fit under the age of 40. And their yogic tradition was primarily to prepare them for battle, to give them physical and mental stamina, and to give them unfailing confidence. And there are wonderful legends about their ability to ward off spears and arrows just from the energy of the body itself. And there is a sequence of postures that I teach that it is used by this military monk tradition. And seven postures, which in the monasteries would take 3 hours to do once through. Now, I only have an hour and a half with the singers, but teaching them the sequence over the years, they respond extremely well to it. And I tried it simply as an experiment initially, but I was amazed at the way performers were able to grasp this and use it and continue using it for years without me. Now, once they were traveling around the world, I still get reports from friends who are saying they're using it in their hotel rooms, they use it backstage before they go on at the Met or wherever it is. So it seems to suit them very well because it prepares the body, it prepares the mind, it opens the lungs, it relaxes the diaphragm and enables them to walk on stage with far greater confidence.
How did you yourself take up this practice? How did you become involved?
My very first journey across India, I came across this tantric tradition of which I knew nothing at all. And I had such extraordinary experiences with it and found myself unexpectedly and without request being initiated into the tradition, the Nepalese tradition of the Eastern Himalaya.
How did you just stumble across it? Like, was there a community center with a sign?
No. I found I had very intimate connections in that area. I discovered that my childhood hero, which was a great uncle who was a tea planter in India, had taken a tribal wife. He'd taken a princess from the Lepcha tribe. And so on that first journey, not knowing this except by rumor that I'd heard from my grandmother, I discovered that I had 32 blood cousins living in the Eastern Himalaya, of whom nothing had been spoken. And it was through them, through one of my cousins, who I bonded with very quickly, that I was taken deeper into the mountains to a solitary man on a hillside below the Kanchenjunga.
Oh, get out! Not really. A solitary
absolutely.
Man on the hillside?
Absolutely true.
That is unbelievable. That's fantastic.
And not knowing what I was walking into, I experienced something that completely defies my Western understanding of myself or even of physics.
How's now that? You're going to tell me what it was.
I don't know if I can.
Yes, you can.
Well,
because you're not leaving this room. I don't care how much energy you can spurt out. I don't care what kind of tantric tricks you can pull out. You're not leaving this room until you tell me.
It's all described in my book, actually, In the Shadow of Crows.
Okay.
He took me through an initiation ritual, about which I knew nothing at the time. I've since, in my efforts to understand my experience, I have read in numerous academic books on the tradition, on the tribes, and so forth. None, however, have yet described the experience that I had, even though it's fairly standard amongst that community. He took me through an extraordinary practice during which I had to be stripped naked and sit in the freezing cold, and it was very, very cold. And he put onto my body and into my mouth various herbal concoctions. But the tantric tradition, this Jakri tradition as it's called, uses the plants in order to experience and explore shifts in consciousness. It's all about the expansion of consciousness. And
you're so not getting specific.
You have to read the book.
I haven't had a chance yet, I'm sorry.
Well, the experience was very literally life-changing. Nothing was ever the same again. It changed my concept of the relationship that I was in at the time. It changed the direction of my life dramatically. And it has driven me on a pursuit to understand more of our capacity as humans because of the experience that I had. For example, I found that very quickly I was losing all sense of time, for example, which is fascinating in itself, to have no sense of myself within a continuum, within a linear structure of time. I had no concept of myself as having any sort of gender at all. And this increased to not being able to tell whether I was human or plant. Do you want me to carry on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sounds like you're describing, a kind of a peyote experience or something. Almost.
Yeah, a sort of trip.
Yeah,
basically. But then he began to use pressure points in my body and using different plant oils, which he was pouring on different parts of my body. And my chest seemed to freeze, seemed to turn to ice. My umbilical cords seemed to set on fire. Well, the remnants of my umbilical cords seemed to set on fire. And then I went into convulsions, but it was not unpleasant. Physical and mental convulsions, which seemed to change everything, seemed to deconstruct all my preconceptions about myself and about the world as it is. And nothing has ever been the same.
Wow. This is David Charles Manners, who works at the Glyndebourne Festival as a physical therapist and is the author of a book called In the Shadow of Crows, which is about two journeys in India. We can say this is a novelization, yes, but it's based largely on your experience. And you also have an involvement there with a charity which has a long-form name and a short-form name, and you and your partner, Bernard, are, in fact, the charity. What's it called?
Sarvashupamkara, which is a Sanskrit term meaning he who does good to all. We use the shortened version in the West of Sarva.
Sarva.
Yeah.
And what does it do?
We work with ostracized individuals and communities on the Indian subcontinent. The majority of the people we work with are isolated socially because of leprosy or because of the stigma of leprosy. But we are actively engaged looking for these isolated people and communities. We work with them to set up educational projects, social and medical projects with them also. Our time is spent at Glyndebourne throughout the summer. Bernard, who is the co-founder, is the company manager at Glyndebourne. We spend our time there with wonderful support from the company itself and from various singers and musicians who offer their time for free to raise money on our behalf. And then as soon as the company goes out on tour, Bernard and I return to India and to the projects there.
Where do you live there?
We have a home up in the northeast Himalaya in a hill town called Kalimpong. But a lot of our projects are now being undertaken on the plains where the problems are far greater, particularly in the slums of the northern plains of India.
This is a very involved and extensive story, the situation of people with leprosy. I attended a reading that you gave in Vancouver a little better than a week ago, and you made the point that people who have leprosy don't like to be known as lepers because it just seems to define the whole sense of being.
Exactly.
But what's the population in India? It's huge.
Of people with leprosy?
Yeah, well, people with leprosy and people who are
affected by it. Okay. The World Health Organization says that about 12 million people are affected by leprosy on the Indian subcontinent at the moment. However, about 100 million people are affected by the stigma of that disease, because if one individual in a family is infected, the stigma is applied to the entire family. So we work, for example, in one slum where there are four generations of a family who are completely isolated. The children can get no state education. They will never be able to get jobs. They'll never be able to move out of the slum. They will only be able to marry within the slum to somebody else with the same stigma, even though it's only the grandparent, the great-grandparent and grandparent who actually has been affected by the disease.
It's hard to imagine a greater contrast between Glyndebourne on the one hand and that on the other.
There couldn't be a greater contrast at all. And we are both extremely aware of the extraordinary luxury to be able to work in a place like Glyndebourne, which is so beautiful and inspiring in many ways. But spending time in India with people who are so disenfranchised is actually the perfect balance, because if it was full time in a place like Glyndebourne, with all its luxuries, with all its money,
oh, those lovely sandwiches,
lovely expensive sandwiches, it would be very hard to justify our existence, I have to say. It brings a balance.
I love singers, and I love talking to singers. Mm. But often it seems to me that the singer's world doesn't go much beyond the singer and the need to be able to put out on the night and to make the beautiful sound that can be heard at the back of the hall and so on. Mm. It is maybe of necessity, and this obviously does not universally apply, a kind of goad to self-absorption, the
Absolutely.
Singer's life.
Very true.
So sometimes when you're doing your work at Glyndebourne with these singers and you're doing your hands-on work, do you just want to push a button to make them a little less self-absorbed?
Yes.
Do you want to say more about that?
I have to be very careful here.
They're not listening.
There are times when I would like to push my elbow a little deeper in than it needs to be. It can be very difficult, and sometimes the return journey, coming back from working with these very extraordinary people in extremely difficult circumstances.
You're talking about India now.
India, yes. Yeah. Coming back to Glyndebourne and having somebody lie there and moan about the dress that they have to wear for this rehearsal period, or for the colour of the stockings that they have to wear in a particular scene. I do have to bite my lip pretty hard at times. But at the same time, I have to understand that, as you said, by the nature of their job, a level of self-obsession is required to get on that stage and to sing like they do. It's extraordinarily demanding and has its place. But again, it's all about balance.
Next week, we're doing Rusalka. Well, we're not doing it. We're presenting it. production from the Canadian Opera Company. And you were in Vancouver, and I should say you've been here doing more family research. Mm. But you were in Vancouver when there was that unfortunate episode with, I think it was Anna Maria Martinez.
Mm.
Yeah, Anna Maria Martinez, who fell from the stage into the pit. Mm. And mercifully was not badly injured.
No.
And was up and singing again. Had you been there, What would your involvement have been with her, do you think, post that?
Well, I know Anna Maria quite well, mm. and I would have been putting my hands where they needed to be put in order to just rebalance her, help her regain a bit of physical confidence, and check things out to make sure that everything was where it should be. But she hasn't really suffered at all physically, quite amazingly. The impact was taken by the cello.
That's too bad. The cellist was okay, but
the cellist was fine.
The cello was sort of unseamed from nave to chops.
It was, rather. But apparently it's now restored.
Oh, that's excellent.
So everybody's happy. Apart from the stage manager who turned grey that night, I think.